lost and found, life and death. Which is worse, to be lost or to be dead? Is that a question we can answer? The Father says multiple times, "My son was dead and he is alive." This past week, I was completing a scholarship reference for a seminary student. Sometimes when I'm writing these, I start to panic a little. I worry about what someone would say if they had to answer these questions about me. Have I done enough with my life? Do I have any interesting hobbies? I mean, I have hobbies, but really, are they interesting? I do jigsaw puzzles, and they're not even those ones that are solid white. They're impossible to do. And then I realized getting lost is, if not one of my hobbies, well, at least it's an interesting quality, or maybe you could even call it a talent. Once I left Nashville with a car full of fellow church educators to attend a conference in St. Louis, except that I discovered that we were heading to Knoxville instead. We made it, but we lost a little time. Years earlier, leaving my sister's home in Chicago, I gave us a 2-hour detour with 3 little boys and my mother in the car. She later said, "I thought you missed an exit." But I wasn't going to say anything. Now, my mother, she had a built-in compass. Here's my mother giving directions. Head east on Walnut Grove Road for 5 miles, then turn north. North? East? Which way is east? Is north to your right when you're facing east? I don't know. It's a good thing God moved me to a small town. At least there's less space in which I may get lost. The first week I lived in Tuscaloosa, I would get so turned around trying to find the church. I was afraid it was a sign. I would get close and I would see the stadium, and I knew it had to be a short block away, but I couldn't get there. And before you suggest it, yes, I was using GPS apps on my phone. I have Google Maps, Waze, Apple's Map, whatever that is. And in my defense, the phone took me a different route from Cottondale to 1127 8th Street every day. You'd think there weren't that many ways to get there, but there were. I think the GPS genies do things like this just to mess with your head. With a mischievous gleam in their eye, they say, "Now she has a false sense of security. Let's really confuse her and take her a different way." And how about this? Have you ever made the mistake of having 2 mapping apps open at the same time? Yeah, 2 different voices telling you what to do, and they don't agree. It's like being behind the wheel with 2 teenagers in the car. Now, the biggest problem, however, the biggest problem I have with Google Maps or Waze or whichever one it is that you like to use is that they insist on using numbers. In 500 feet, turn right. Well, I'm not good with distances. Give me a landmark. I want someone to invent a map app that will say, "When you see a castle-shaped building, turn left." Or, "When you come to the fork in the road, turn towards the cemetery, not the ice cream shop." And I don't like interstate numbers. They mean nothing to me. I need road names. Rice Mine Road, Jack Warner Parkway, Lurleen Wallace. They have stories. They mean something. Who can forget names like those? Lurleen Wallace? But 69, 20, 82? I'm lost before you even begin. I can only remember 65 South because it takes you to the beach. Now, we are all wired differently. Some of you would have loved my mother's directions. Some of you can hear 500 feet and see that distance in your mind. Not me. We need a variety of ways of hearing, a range of ways of seeing, because we have a myriad ways of being lost. And so we need a plethora of ways of being found. A father had two sons, two unique sons. The father knew this. He knew that they would get lost in different ways. He knew that they required different forms of discipline. The older son only needed a stern look or to hear the words, "I am so disappointed in you." The younger son could be grounded for a week, lose his cell phone and laptop privileges, and still not feel the pain of his father's frustration. And so, in the shadow of his older brother's perfection, the younger son chose the wildest path he could imagine. He asks for his share of the inheritance, which in effect is proclaiming his father's death. This is what he would get when his father dies. What a strange and hurtful thing to do. And it isn't because he wants to build a house or go to graduate school or because he has a family of his own to support. He just wants to take the money and go have some fun. And his father lets him. And we are screaming, "No, don't do this. Nothing good will come of this." We are thinking, "That slacker dad, he's going to have his eyes opened." Except that his eyes were already open. He knew his son. He probably was not at all surprised when his son came to him asking for the money. Nor was he shocked by the outcome. He knew when his son headed out with pockets full of coins that nothing good could come of it. So why did he let him go? Well, because the son would have left anyway. In truth, his son had left long before he struck out towards the bright lights of the city. We love to look at this story through rose-colored glasses, a story of forgiveness and reunion. And that is here in miracle and mystery. But let's be honest. When the younger son, covered in mud and pig slop, comes to his senses, it is just the first step. He isn't really fully aware of his condition. When he says, "My father's servants have more food than they need," he is making a commentary on what he thinks he deserves. It isn't a compliment to his father for treating his servants with kindness. It is the revelation that he sees himself as above them, as more deserving. His eyes are not completely open yet. Until he can see himself, not in competition with other human beings, and most especially the servants or his brother, not in competition, but in cooperation, until he can see that, he will remain lost. We are left to wonder, will the younger son seek a different way of life? Has he truly been found? Or does he remain lost to himself, lost to his family, lost to his community, lost to God? When will he understand that his father has love enough for both sons? It isn't either or, it is both and. Both are invited to a party. Will both of them come? And what would happen if these two brothers are allowed to meet? Aren't you curious about that? Jesus keeps them apart in this parable. They never interact. If the older brother does clean up and come to the party, will he stand across the room, glaring at his younger brother from the corner or laughing about him with his friends? Will he haul him outside and punch him? Will he find a way to embrace him, even if it is a cold, meaningless embrace? Or will he find a way to forgive himself? Will he find a way to forgive himself for being jealous will he find a way to forgive himself for being resentful of a carefree younger sibling? Will he find a way to forgive himself for pushing his brother away? Will he finally be relieved of the heavy weight of responsibility that older siblings so often feel for the younger ones? And what about you? Will you come to this party? If the father is your friend, your peer, your neighbor, do you want to celebrate the return of a son who hurt his father so deeply? Could you? Would you be afraid that you were condoning the son's behavior? Theologian J. William Harkins writes, All religions provide some means by which the sinner can return and make restitution. But to come back to a party? That indeed is a surprise. What kind of religion can this be? And would any of us have attended this party? In our limited way of understanding, our limited way of forgiving, our limited way of loving, the party doesn't make sense. In fact, we resent it. We want the party to be for the older, obedient son. Sure, give the younger son a cloth robe, a gold ring, and woven sandals if you want to. But give the older son a silk robe, a ruby ring, and beautiful leather shoes. It is so often either or for us. Until we admit we have been the younger son, until we admit we have, on some occasion, turned our backs on love as we walked away from God's home. Who among us has not, at some moment, been ungrateful and unaware of the abundance offered to us? Who hasn't wasted opportunities to be loved? The father knew what each son needed. The younger son wasted his money, fine foods, fancy clothes, whatever money could buy. So when he returned home, his father gave him fine foods, fancy clothes, a little bling. That doesn't make much sense, does it? Why would he do that? Why? But to show him that all these things he thought would make him happy had been there all along. And all those possessions, apart from the love of family, they were absolutely meaningless and so easily lost. The older son, when his younger brother left, he didn't have to share a room anymore. He didn't have to make excuses for his brother who would sneak out after curfew. He didn't have to be resentful or jealous of his ungrateful and foolish brother or the shame that he had brought to their family. He never left home. And so it would seem he wasn't lost. The older son was not at risk of being lost until, you know the moment? The moment when his father threw a party for his brother. That was the moment of great danger. That was the moment when he was forced to choose resentment or forgiveness. The father's invitation to his older son is the invitation to love expansively and generously without any boundaries. This father takes bold risks in this story. He takes a risk by allowing one son to leave and an even greater risk in welcoming him home. And we don't get to decide who God welcomes. We don't get to choose who God forgives. God's grace is both mysterious and wonderful. God's mercy is both frightening and abundant. And, Harkins writes, the truth that often baffles and disturbs our minds is that we can fall from justice. We can fall from faith. We can fall from righteousness, but we cannot fall from grace. And though we cannot fall from grace, I believe we can lose our way even in the midst of grace. So we must discern which voices are guiding us in truth, and we must acknowledge the value of community to help us in our discernment. Together, we are better able to experience the depth of God's wisdom, the wideness of God's grace. Together, we are better able to embody that grace, to live it out in the world. There was a funny thread on a friend's Facebook page this week. It was about a local landmark, one that belongs on our mapping software. It's fondly referred to as Jesus in a box. Now, evidently, it is actually the Good Shepherd, but same difference, really, right? Good Shepherd, Jesus. This person posted directions on how to find Jesus in a box. Straight up 43, he's on the left. Okay? Other comments included, this was a destination of the Million Dollar Band field trip. That's interesting. Another comment, he's a good bit out of town. Take that as you will. Evidently, he is well known. If you get to Jesus in a box, you've gone too far, is one way that directions are given. That, as they say, will preach. If you get to Jesus in a box, you've gone too far. Now, Jesus in a box is much less threatening, much less forgiving also, and much less merciful. If your faith allows you to put Jesus in a box, you've gone too far. If we let him out, he's gonna throw parties for anyone and everyone, and that includes us. And I don't know about you, but I've always hated going to parties by myself. Together, so much more fun. Then I'm not nearly as worried about what to wear or if I brought the right thing. So shall we go? Shall we go together? Let's go. And when we get there, let us give thanks to God, the host of love's party, a come-as-you-are extravaganza. Thanks be to God, the God of grace. Amen.